They're trying to develop drones that actually can be used for pollination. So you're talking nearly insect or bee-sized drones that can be used for pollination of plants, sort of with a view toward, there's been quite a lot of bee collapse in various countries. So there's sort of a thought on replacing that function in the natural world with something like drones.
Welcome to The Defense Never Rests with Morgan and Akins, your monthly dose of uncommon sense about all things legal and some that are not.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to The Defense Never Rests. We have a great podcast today. Wendy Smith, I'm here with my coworker, Nate Bolander, and we're going to talk about drones and risks and policy coverage of drones. So we have today with us Travis Wary, who is the Chief Operating Officer from Rain Connected Insurance Agency, which is unique in that they write drone insurance policies. And also we have with us today is Joe Titelman, who is a forensic engineer with ARCA, who has spoken with me in the past with regards to risk management and drone use. And he's an expert in drone use, in accident reconstruction, and in the use of litigation.
Yeah, so, drones are some of the most exciting things, at least for me. And I think we're going to see them used in a lot more ways in the future. So I'm really excited for this one. Let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Defense Never Rests podcast. Today, we have a very, very special show. We're here with two drone experts in different fields, Joe Titelman and Travis Wary. You'll hear from them about how they got into the drone space, what they do in their specific fields, and where the drone arena is going in the future. So without further ado, let me introduce both of them, and we'll start with Joe. Do you just want to tell us how you got into the drone world and what brought you here?
Sure. Well, thank you, Nate and Wendy, for having me on. How I got into the drone world was getting involved in accident investigation and reconstruction. And I work for ARCA, which is a forensic engineering company, operates nationwide doing accident reconstruction, biomechanics, crashworthiness, and failure analysis. And when I got involved with ARCA, I was still a student studying mechanical engineering at Temple University. And while I was studying, I was spending my summers working at ARCA, learning from various experts in various fields and participating in some research and some testing. And when I started full-time as an accident reconstructionist here at ARCA, really I started to specialize in different areas of newer technologies that we're seeing in the reconstruction space. So that might be ADOS and vehicle autonomy, which is a specialty area of mine. It might be something like laser scanning, or what we're talking about today is drones. So one of the first things I did, and maybe something we'll talk about a little bit later, is go and get my FAA Part 107 license so I can commercially operate a drone for purposes in accident investigation and reconstruction. And I started to build up what has become a nice little drone program here at ARCA, going out and documenting physical evidence when reconstructing car accidents.
Just very, very briefly for folks that don't know, just in a couple sentences, what is accident reconstruction?
Sure. So accident reconstruction is the application of physics and mathematics to studying collision events. So any question that an insurance company or maybe something in the legal space, any question that might arise regarding a collision event, whether it be who's at fault, how fast was one vehicle going, those are the sorts of things that as accident reconstructionists we look at, and we apply scientific methodologies to answer those questions to a degree of certainty.
And we'll get into how you do that because I think it's fascinating, but I do want to let Travis go because he's got a completely different, he comes at the drone space from a completely different avenue. And I wanted to ask him how he got into that and also to explain it for us.
Yeah, well, similarly, thanks, Nate. Thanks, Wendy, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here and to meet you all. I did come into the drone space quite differently. I'm a litigator by trade and training. That's sort of how I got my start. And I had practiced in the sort of insurance coverage litigation field along with the business litigation field for about 4 years prior to going in-house with sort of a medium-sized property and casualty insurance group, and was in-house counsel there for a couple of years managing their litigation, handling some of the regulatory work and doing some of the other odd jobs that I'll end up doing. When I was sort of connected with an old colleague of mine from the law firm who had moved into the GC role here at Rain. And Rain itself is an insurtech company, which we can talk a little bit more about what that is. But the first product that they rolled out in connection with one of their partners was a drone insurance product specifically. So that's sort of how I got into the drone based. So I come into it from the legal, the regulatory, the insurance angles, all of which are pretty highly significant with drone operation and then certainly drone insurance.
I think it's important to take a step back and just ask, and I'll ask Joe first, but Travis, I would love if you weighed in too. You know, this is going to be the most open-ended question you'll get during the podcast, but what is a drone? Because I think a lot of folks think of a drone, they say, okay, a quadcopter about the size of a bread box, someone has a remote control on the ground, but it's much, much more than that, isn't it, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, so the definition that the FAA really gives it is either UAV or SUAS, UAV standing for unmanned aerial vehicle, although that could have a broader, you know, more military definition potentially, but SUAS, which is kind of the definition that FAA gives us for the license that you would get to commercially operate a drone, is small unmanned aerial system. The definition that's provided there has kind of a range of sizes, a range of weights, and it is, you know, for our purposes, exactly what you said, usually a quadcopter, but sometimes, you know, as many as six rotors, and just a little vehicle that you can control with a remote control on the ground and go fly, to take some photographs or some video or attach some other sensors to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. You know, there's different constructions of them, and sometimes those constructions are pretty tightly applied to or very closely related to the job they do. So like Joe was saying, you know, a lot of these are quadcopters or based on those similar types of construction. You have fixed wing drones that are meant to fly further distances in large swaths. You'll see them a lot in commercial agriculture. You obviously have different ones for military applications. Some of those are fixed wings, some of those have elements of both. And, you know, not to get too far off the rails, but there are underwater drones and the like. Those are a bit different, but they do sort of exist in the same space and operate a little bit differently.
Awesome. How did you guys, when you got, I think Travis, I'm going to start with you. I know you were talking about like your former colleague kind of got you into RAID in this space, but you may tell me that you guys saw the drone space as kind of a pain point. And that's sort of how you evolved writing policies for drones. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So the drones have been around for a little bit, but their use in commercial applications is ramping up considerably. I mean, I think there's plenty of literature to that effect. I'm sure Joe obviously is involved in some of that himself and has seen quite a few of those applications, I'm sure, multiply over the past 10 or so years. But what we found was a pain point is that as that was such a nascent industry, the way that a lot of drone businesses operate is a little different than some other small and medium enterprises do. The nature of the work that they conduct is a bit different, and thus their needs, particularly on the insurance side, are also a little bit different. So I think there was a bit of a reflex to just simply say, well, if you have a small, you know, business operator policy or commercial general liability policy, then, I mean, you're a business, this will work for you. But those weren't particularly suitable for a few reasons. One, there were some challenges with some exclusions. You know, a lot of them have an aviation exclusion. There's been a variety of case law that has, you know, put the operation of a drone in that squarely within those exclusions in several jurisdictions. So there was problems there. And even sort of, you can ameliorate that pretty fast, right? That's not that hard to remove an exclusion from a policy, but there's also just often a rough fit between the coverages that are in those bigger, broader policies versus what a drone operator actually does. So part of the challenge they had was finding a policy that suited them, right? In terms of, I need, it doesn't try to provide me coverages I don't want that I have to pay for. And then part of it was the way they do business. A lot of the drone operators in various commercial spaces need a certain degree of flexibility in terms of how they have their coverage because their jobs can be somewhat last minute. They may not necessarily know the particular asset they want to use until they get to a site based on weather conditions, based on a number of factors. So what they were really needing to do was to be able to tailor that coverage, A, only have it when they need it to fly, and then B, tailor it to the conditions that they're actually going to, you know, encounter when they go to complete a job. And with traditional insurance delivery mechanisms, with traditional insurance policies, it's kind of hard to do that. In a fully traditional sense, you need to go get an endorsement from an agent. He needs to go talk to, you know, he or she needs to go talk to their carrier and come back to you. And sometimes that just the very mechanical process of it can be difficult. So the other part of the equation that we tried to help them solve was a sort of fully digital end-to-end experience that they could manage themselves, right? They could buy flight coverage when they needed it. They didn't have to have it on when they weren't flying. They didn't need to go anyone to do that. They could access it from their mobile phone, potentially from a job site. and just make it more an easier part of their workflow, not something that had to be something they were sitting at their, you know, their home desk or their home office computer to do with some sort of dedicated time frame.
Yeah, I was thinking about all the new trends out there. I mean, you see this every day, new trends on drone use. And I read something really interesting today that Polaris Market Research, and I'm not really sure, to be honest with you, who Polaris Market is, but they did a research project and they are saying that medical drones, you know, I know we've talked about, especially with COVID going on, these drones that are dropping medical supplies, which we can talk about a little bit, but they're saying that they anticipate the medical drone market by 2027, which is 7 years from now, is going to be $947 million market. So if anybody is actually going to listen to this podcast, I know it because I'm giving you a little financial tip here. Start investing in these drones. But, you know, like Joe or Travis, what have you seen with regards to like some of these new trends, like such as medical supplies, any issues from the coverage side or from like even the using them in an investigation type situation?
So I can take part of that and I'll probably have to tender to Joe for the investigation side, but we have, you know, some of our carrier partners have been actively involved in ensuring programs that some of their, you know, their large clients use to deliver medical supplies on certain hospitals. And, you know, what's really interesting about that is that, to me anyway, I was sort of ignorant of the way that these could be used to displace, you know, sort of a hard mechanism, being that, you know, these are regular deliveries that happen periodically throughout a day. But, and you're talking within a hospital campus from labs to another portion or for delivery of medical supplies. So it's a regular thing, which is perfect for a drone, right? You can set up a cadence, you can automatically program the flight. All you really need the operator to do is to load the payload, press the button, on it goes. And obviously be there in the event that something appears to be going wrong to try and take control and salvage it. But there is a huge need for that because, you know, drones flying locally on those campuses, right? They can obviously avoid certain other obstacles in terms of traffic and everything else. So there's a good efficiency in just getting around a hospital campus. So, you know, there are a number of challenges with that. And like you mentioned, on the coverage side of things, you worry about things like, well, if something bad does happen and the drone crashes, you're not just looking at potentially a property damage loss for the drone or maybe even a liability loss for it crashing into someone's windshield over a parking lot. But you're looking at it from the spoilage of whatever it was delivering, whether that's supplies, whether it's, you know, blood, whether it's what have you. I mean, it can be carrying any number of things. So those are the things you have to sort of keep in mind and present the sort of fun challenges on, you know, how do we cover this? What exactly liabilities are actually in play here, given what's being delivered? But it's definitely a useful tool. And I think one that many hospital campuses are looking forward to making use of.
Yeah, I think along those lines, some of the hoops and challenges that you have to go through in a country like US to implement a technology for use like this, some of those don't exist in some more developing countries. And for that reason, there's a lot of news, whether it be like from Rwanda, where they're delivering medical supplies already with drones regularly. And it's not, as Travis has said, you know, from one hospital building to another on the same campus, but it's to someone's home or to a doctor's office, you know, miles and miles away. And I think it's a little bit easier for them to set that up and coordinate that, because there's a lot less regulation in place. There's a lot less maybe political, you know, arguing and pressure over different laws with airspace. So it really is interesting to kind of see how maybe a more underdeveloped country could implement much more efficiently, much more safely, certain technologies with drones than we can, at least in a short period of time.
Well, Joe, you mentioned when you introduced yourself, you have an FAA license. Why? So if you were going, if there was a case that was brought up, be it property damage or maybe you got hit with a drone, how would you go, you know, well, I would tender you as an expert in the case. Is that all you need for drone use, is this FAA license?
Yeah, so for commercial operation of a drone, like what I would do if I was going to an accident scene to document physical evidence, what you need is the Part 107 license. And to acquire that, you need to study and prepare and then take a test, a knowledge-based test, on airspace restrictions and weather, different things dealing with the weather and safe flight operations, regulations, things like that.
Can they make you do a driving test? Like, you know, when we do it, can you operate your drone in a straight line?
It's funny, and things are still changing, right? We're new into this realm, but as it stands today, you could hold a Part 107 unmanned aerial vehicle license and have never touched the controller, never flown it. So that, as it stands today, that's how it is. In the future, potentially, I could see, you needing some flight hours, as they would call it, for different other types of pilot's license. But no, right now, it really is. It's just that knowledge-based test. And again, they're really interested in you understanding where you can and cannot fly. Again, certain weather issues that could potentially create some dangerous situations, things like that. And then really, as a pilot, you're governed by, the federal regulations and then any state and local law. And federal regulations are pretty simple, right? You want to keep the drone within your line of sight. That's a big one for standard application. You're going to fly it below either 400 feet above ground level, or if you're looking at a structure, 400 feet above that structure, whether it be a taller building, a bridge, whatever it might be. And then you're going to not fly over moving vehicles, not fly over people. Certain things, safety, that if you follow those, restrictions and regulations and your license, that's really all you need to fly. So Travis, I don't know if you have anything to add to that one.
No, I think that's right. I mean, the FAA will in certain limited conditions provide waivers for some of those applications that Joe was talking about. So if if you want to fly a particular flight beyond your line of sight, or if you are in the film industry and you plan on flying a commercial that's going to be hovering over people, like, you can apply for waivers for those things. And there's certain very large, well, I should say very few, but certain large individual or large enterprises that can get or blanket waivers for some of that stuff. And then, but to his point, you're right. I mean, that's really, in terms of a licensure, that's largely all you need. There are some different variants. If you're going to be operating a drone that weighs more than 55 pounds, for example, there's a different statutory special authority for that. I think it's 49 USC 44807, I think, something
which
like
I'm
that.
I'm going to fact check that.
I think that's it. So there's that one. And then, if there's a very small sliver where if you're going to be flying your drone on behalf of like a governmental entity, search and rescue outfit for a law enforcement division or something like that, there's a different certification for those folks, which operates largely like a Part 107 would for commercial pilots. But that, and Joe was very right to point out that, certain jurisdictions have an additional layer potentially of restrictions on top of those federal regulations. And a lot of times those are tied to where you're flying. In terms of both the airspace, in terms of what's around you. So it's a developing field, as Joe mentioned, but right now it's still more or less in its infancy, I think I describe it as, from a regulatory standpoint. For example, there's a lot of big holes that aren't present in more mature industries, like compulsory insurance, for example. In the United States, it's not a thing. It's purely driven by a client demand at this point. There's been discussions here, there's been discussions in the UK about instituting that, for all applications as opposed to just some, but it's very, very much a developing area.
You mentioned, I was to say, you mentioned specific licenses required for certain drone usages. And I think one of the most interesting things about drones is the number of ways in which they're used. I mean, I think people know about hobbyists. People know about, Amazon trying to deliver packages by drones. I wrote an article that began with a couple years ago, Lady Gaga had her halftime show and the light display was drones. No one knew it at the time, but that was, so what are some other ways that drones are being used? I think Travis, you mentioned that you have some insurance that use them for crop and property purposes to oversee farmland, things like that. And Joe, I'd love to get into what you're doing with Accident Reconstruction, how drones help you with that. So Travis, what are you seeing in the whole world of drones, how they're being used, and where are some really interesting ones?
Yeah, so it's pretty fascinating because there's definitely a field of use that I would say is the most common, right? So there's a large number of fairly standard commercial applications, accident reconstruction being one of them, insurance claim investigation being another. Those are related. Sometimes it's not fully accident reconstruction. Sometimes it's just taking survey of damage from a hailstorm, for example, to a roof. That insurance adjusters will often contract with someone to use a drone for. commercial agriculture has a fairly large application, whether that's simply investigating crop yields or not crop yields, excuse me, crops themselves for like in crops that are going bad or that are in need of remediation that they can use to sort of pinpoint where they have unhealthy areas of their crop and thus maximize their yield. Some of the sensors that go with those drones are pretty incredible in terms of what they can see.
They're saying that about California right now for the California fires. They have drones going out to assess damage and what could be the possible long-term and short-term recovery of those natural reserves out there.
Yeah, and if you think about it, I mean, it makes total sense. The view that they can give you and the distances that they can cover dwarf what you could otherwise get by other means, or they're simply less expensive than using a full-on helicopter to do the same thing. So there's search and rescue, to your point about California. There's search and rescue is another variant where they've been used. I mean, there's been literally dozens of people who have saved by drone efforts managing to find them when they were in distress and needing help. And then there's larceries, gas, for example, flying pipelines for inspection purposes. Drones are often used for that. Cell phone towers or other utility towers performing inspections of those. So those are sort of your, a very small microcosm of what I would call some of the standard uses. And that doesn't even touch film being perhaps one of the bigger actually users of that, both for movie as well as commercials and the like. But then there's some sort of new ones that are coming around that are pretty interesting. Some pretty advanced home security systems can use them either on a tethered or non-tethered basis in connection with other cameras and AI that sort of monitors, may scare some people, but sort of monitors the activity of your property and then sort of alerts you when something's abnormal. I don't know how much that one's going to take off, but it's sort of a new one. One other kind of cool one that I've seen recently was, and I think it's in Japan, they're trying to develop drones that actually can be used for pollination. So you're talking nearly insect or bee-sized drones that can be used for pollination of plants, sort of with a view toward, there's been quite a lot of bee collapse in various countries. So there's sort of a thought on replacing that function in the natural world with something like drones. So there's a lot of...
Bring all of these types of uses too?
So the standard one, we certainly do. Some of these other ones are newly developing, so it's things that have come across our radar. A fire, another one that has come across our radar, and whether we do or don't is largely at the carrier's discretion. So but yeah, it's kind of interesting to see some of the new uses coming to the fore.
And Joe, what uses are you seeing, and could you get into how you use them in accident reconstruction?
So I'll start off to describe kind of how I use it as an investigator and a reconstructionist, and really it's all about documenting physical evidence. So picture yourself driving up to the scene of an accident, and there's gouge marks in the roadway, vehicle debris, maybe some fluid spilled, certainly tire marks or yaw marks from pre and post impact vehicle dynamics. Really what we want to do is we want to document that as a first step as well as we possibly can. Police officers, when they're investigating a collision, are already going to be doing that, but as private reconstructionists, that is also our first goal, because it's going to help us with any analysis of the crash later on. And so, traditionally we're using measuring tapes, roller wheels, cameras. More recently, in the past kind of 10 years, we're implementing three-dimensional laser scanners for that, which is a really highly accurate, precise way of taking measurements of an accident scene. And then drones came along, right? And for us, what a drone is it's a way to get a camera in a position that we never could get it before. While video of an accident scene flying through and seeing different perspectives is great, and while a single photograph is really fantastic, really the application that we're using this for is we are taking sometimes hundreds of individual photographs of the scene of an accident or of a building that we're inspecting or anything like that. And we're using software to stitch those photographs together into a photogrammetric model, meaning we're no longer just looking at a single photograph, but we're looking at an actual 3D space that we can move between, take different perspectives of, and actually take measurements of in a way that we really can never do before. And really, where drone technology comes into play is it's great for use in accident reconstruction, but it's even better when you combine it with other technologies. So you take that three-dimensional model that you created with drone photographs, You combine it with laser scans. You combine it with physical evidence documented by the police on scene that may not be there by the time we get there. And you really can start to have evidence documented in a way that we never could before.
Have you faced challenges at trial with admitting those 3D models into evidence because it's such a new technology?
Yeah. So it has been studied and has been compared to other evidence documentation techniques. So there are papers and there are journal articles which reference, you know, the accuracy of some of the methods that we can use. Photogrammetry, which is kind of the umbrella term for what's going on there, where you're stitching together photos, that predates drones. So really, you know, there's science to back up taking measurements from photographs, essentially, and it can definitely be supported.
Travis, how does one get coverage for drones? And I know you're at a commercial space, and I know you have something that we've talked about before this podcast, something called the Wizard.
You're on mute.
Sorry, trying to be polite and I got myself in trouble. So there's several different ways that you can procure drone insurance. Everything most traditional, which I sort of referenced earlier with respect to contacting an agent, having the policy. Ours is a little different. So as I mentioned earlier in the call, we have sort of a fully digital distribution mechanism. What Wendy referenced with the Wizard is sort of what we affectionately call the sort of step-by-step process that we walk an individual drone operator or commercial operator, I should say, sort of through our process to give us the necessary information that we can use to, basically process their application, if you want to think of it that way, as well as have our system apply the ratings to what they're going to do and ultimately deliver them sort of an instantaneous dynamically generated quote. And then if they like what they see, then allows them to proceed to purchase the policy, generate their documents, and sort of have their certificates of insurance that they can provide to their clients as sort of at their fingertips. It's just on demand. That's just how it works. So yeah, that Wizard process is basically them telling us about themselves as a pilot, their business, their drones and, their history with respect to accidents or losses and their licensure, that kind of information that you would normally have to get over to an insurance carrier for them to sort of look at you and rate you. And then spitting them out to the actual coverage selection process where they can tell us, here's our options. You can select what you want. You can see the prices as you change things and then go with whatever suits your needs.
Do you have to, when you go through the Wizard, would I have to be FAA licensed? Like, do they ask those types of questions?
They do. Yeah. And for our particular product, given that it's geared toward commercial operators, yes, you would either to have, the Part 107 that Joe indicated he has, and I think that's by and large the vast majority of the people that would come through our platform. There are still some lingering Section 333 licenses out there, although they sunset that provision in favor earlier. So it's a couple of those. If you have a drone or 55 pounds, you'd have to select your licensure. Or if you're flying on behalf of a governmental entity, you can sort of indicate that to us as well. But yes, to your question, you would have to indicate one of those to be sort of eligible for the product through droneinsurance.com.
What does it cover? We talked about, from the user who's going to tell you that they are licensed and they have a license, to what happens if they, by accident, hit somebody, with the drone while they're scoping it out.
Yeah, so our product itself is sort of delineated into two parts, if you want to think of it that way. One we call base coverage, which covers the typical exposures that a drone operator may face on the ground, which admittedly, hopefully are more limited, but also provides optional things like theft coverage and invasion of privacy coverage is in there as well, that kind of thing. And then there's the flight coverage, and that covers the sort of risks that are probably most acutely faced by drone operators. And that's the liability you mentioned with respect to, if the worst happened, your drone lost GPS signal and it fell out of the sky and hit someone or their car, you might be the subject of a liability claim, so it would provide you a defense and potential indemnity for that. And then similarly, it also, if you have selected physical damage coverage, provides you that. So in the event that you don't hurt anyone or anything, but your drone is totaled or harmed as a result of the flight, that you would enjoy coverage for that.
When you're looking to write policies for insurance, Travis, you talked about the operator having to have a Part 107 license. But what about the drone itself? Is it like car insurance where if you drive a brand new Volvo and it's really safe, your policy costs less? If you drive a 78 Pinto, your coverage costs more?
So that's a really interesting question, because one of the challenges and for us an opportunity in the drone space is that there isn't the type of historical loss data for drones that there is for cars, right? There's been a lot less testing for that. And they also have been changing fairly rapidly, and not just in terms of their hardware, but their software. So one of the big things that we do at Rain is we have a data science team that has been able to sort of develop a database and algorithm on top of that, that helps us to understand some of those insights, even without having some of that historical loss data at our disposal, by sort of being able to pattern out the factors that are associated with a, I will call it an increased risk of a crash, right? So then you can sort of, you do lots of interesting analysis using that algorithm to identify those kinds of things that seem to lead to, say, for those types of risky situations, whether that's a make and model of a drone, whether it's the software being operated, whether it's the mode that it's being operated in. So, you know, there's systems that you can turn on, sport mode, for example, that allow you to control it more freely, but has fewer safeguards, that kind of thing. And there's a lot of different factors. So part of what we do is take those learnings as we go along and continue to iterate them, and then feed them back to our carrier partners, where we can say, you know, these are some things you guys should consider from a rating perspective, because, you know, what you don't want to end up with is a sort of a, from a pricing perspective, you know, sort of one size fits all. You want to rate your risks as close as you can to the risk they actually pose. So that's one of the things that we try to do, because we, again, it's a new industry. So it doesn't have as ready of a matrix as saying, like you were saying, you know, I got 76 Pentel, I've got an idea of how that looks.
Right.
Travis, I have something to ask on that. So, you know, we're looking at these new uses, and Amazon, you know, UPS, they have these pilot programs that they're going to start making, you know, deliveries to customers with their, you know, products. And I'm wondering, you know, like I look at a company like Amazon, who's used independent contractors to make deliveries, you know, especially now that deliveries have increased. How does that cover somebody that might be, you know, a contractor going to make a delivery for Amazon on the drone end?
It's a good question. It's a really complicated one. So there's a lot of
joke.
Well, and Joe referenced some of them earlier, you know, particularly here in the United States. You know, one of the things that is still lacking really in terms of making that a true reality on any sort of large scale anyway, is one, the regulatory environment, two, sort of a universal traffic management system, that, because our airspaces are busy and they're highly regulated on top of that. So when you're talking about wanting to sort of bring someone like Amazon's vision to realization, you're talking about all of those items that have to come into play. Purely coverage perspective, you know, I can answer the question of, if an independent contractor were working for Amazon today, for example, to conduct a drone operation, you know, typically what would happen is that, you know, the drone operator themselves as an independent contractor would have a policy. They would add Amazon or whatever the client may be as an additional insured on it, provide Amazon a certificate to prove they have insurance, and then go about conducting the job they were hired to do. Where Amazon gets interesting, though, is I think that, you know, their plans, and you can see some of them if you pull any of their patent filings, for example, don't really conceive of pilots really being the one that operate these, at least not in a traditional sense. They conceive of things like, this is going to be a silly sounding word, but like a hive, basically, that houses a number of drones, and those drones, you know, get programmed to go pick up, and they'll probably be pilot loaded at a warehouse and then go to do an automated flight to drop things off, or live themselves at the warehouse and just take packages and do sort of an out and back to the delivery location and bring them back. And then you start talking about mobile versions of these hives and everything else. So it's a pretty grandiose vision, really. And it's a long way out for no small reason, for, like I said, there's a lot of constituent pieces that have to come together to make that real on an Amazon, if that makes sense.
Well, Joe, then I'm going to flip this to you. So let's just say that they have this hive system, they get this launch, they start making out, and there's an accident with a delivery of a package. Is there any type of technology or anything that you look for now with drones tracking that type of information? So if you wanted to do an accident reconstruction, somewhat like with cars, you know, you can pull pieces of cars out and it can give you a lot of data. Is that different?
That's a really good question. And I think the answer is widespread yes. I know the drone that we fly is manufactured by DJI. And even as the user, there is a ton of data, not just where it was and when it was, but how fast was it flying? What mode was it in, like Travis was indicating? And I believe as drone technology continues to advance, the amount of data that is being not only recorded, but transmitted back to, you know, some other location, maybe the hive where the drones are stored for Amazon, that is going to be, you know, absolutely, you know, applicable to an investigation of why a drone went down, whether it be a loss of signal or some, you know, unanticipated object in the air or, you know, something like that. So whether or not there's a controller on the other end, I believe in the future, we're going to see drones recording a lot of data. And when they do go down, we're going to know why, most likely.
So as a drone operator pretty frequently, what are some things, some safety features built into drones anyway? Like I know, you know, in cars, automatic stop now is kind of a thing, lane departure, obviously airbags and seatbelts have been around for a while, but what are some things that are implemented in drones anyway that kind of help the operation and keep them safe?
Yeah, a lot of the mass market drones, specifically the ones manufactured by DJI, do have safety systems similar to what you have in your vehicle. The interesting thing about a drone is you don't just drive it forward and backwards. It can go side to side, up and down. And so really what you're talking about is, you know, all eight directions that you could be flying in, or rather six directions that you could be flying in, to have sensors there to, you know, not allow you to go strike something. And there's kind of two parts in that. One is it'll warn the operator and you do get a buzz on the controller and a warning on the screen that says, hey, you know, you're getting within 15, 20 feet of some object in the forward direction. And then additionally, if you're traveling slow enough, it'll actually try and stop you. These drones are still, you know, you can still crash them. And so really what we do is we pretend as though there's no safety features, right? We fly higher than any objects that we'd be interacting with. And we stay out of the way of any fixed structures, telephone poles, trees, buildings, et cetera, when we're doing our documentation. But certainly, the safety features in drones are continuing to advance. And I would think that in the future, they're going to be even better than they are now.
And Travis, when you write policies for drone users, is it something that's, I know you talked about the different depths of coverage that you have, but do you ever do anything where they're riders to other policies, to other commercial policies?
But there are certainly entities that do. And you know, it kind of depends on really what suits your needs. And sometimes it just boils down to what people already know and they do what they're already knowing what's easiest for them. But there are a lot of times that depends on sort of what you're using your drone for and who you are. So, you know, for someone like Joe or for other commercial operators, the policy that they likely need is a little different than just adding a rider to your homeowner's policy, for example, which may be perfectly suitable for someone who, you know, they're a hobbyist, or that's what we would call them, as a hobbyist. They don't really use the drone for commercial applications. They may not even have a license to do so, but they just, you know, they fly their kids' birthday parties, or they just enjoy flying the drone. But at the same time, they want some measure of protection, right? So they want to get some level of coverage. There's also, you know, entities out there that have apps that you can do that based on where you're flying. You know, so people like Verifly's one, Skywatch is another. I think Flock in the UK is another. So there's options out there in terms of how you want to do it. But whether you sort of do it, you know, through our platform, or whether you do it through an app, or whether you do it as more of a traditional offering as a rider to either an existing commercial policy or a homeowner, there's sort of lots of ways to go about it. It's just a matter of, you know, what provides you the right coverage and what provides you the most convenient way to get it.
What is generally the amount of coverage that people get on these commercial drone policies?
Honestly, from our experience, it's largely client driven. And I say client driven in the sense of, you know, what the job itself is. You know, there are plenty of applications where sort of your standard $1 million in liability is perfectly fine. There's other times that, you know, it's often that, you know, gas companies, for example, mining companies will require you to have 5 or 10. And there are certain applications that you may need up to 25 or more. So I think by and large, it really just depends on the type of job you're doing, you know, and the risk that the client perceives in you doing that job with a drone around their equipment or around their facility. So it really just depends on what they sort of tell you have to have.
I kind of want to ask one question to both of you, but in very different ways. So from a macro level, Travis, from a micro level, Joe, what's the biggest risk about flying a drone? So I guess, Travis, you would answer about what the types of claims you see the most where you when you investigate why the incident may have occurred. And Joe, you operate these drones. I don't know how many hours you have operating them, but what is the thing that if you were going to speak to a person who wasn't operating them yet but wanted to get into that, hey, you know, when you do, please be careful of X. What's the one thing that you would say that would help people trying to operate drones safely?
So I can take the first part of that. From our perspective, you know, what we see is the biggest danger. It depends on how you mean biggest. So if you mean biggest in terms of the most frequently experienced type of calamity, sounds like a strong word, but incident that comes out of flying the drone, it's almost always something having gone wrong in flight and the drone being damaged, flown away, destroyed, something along those lines. That in terms of frequency, that's probably the most frequent occurrence we see is something happened to the drone in flight, it crashed or it flew away, and now the drone itself is at a loss of some kind. I think what everyone worries about, which we haven't, you know, thankfully, seen really much of, is more the liability aspect of it. That a similar set of circumstances comes up and the drone becomes either inoperable or it gets away from someone or it hits something and then it causes a significant amount of damage. You know, from our perspective, that's been a lot less frequent. And even when it has happened, you know, these are, I mean, most of these drones, frankly, weigh less than, you know, 20 pounds. So the type of damage that they do isn't typically crazy. But, you know, I think what everyone fears is, you know, a 57 pound quadcopter carrying a massive camera falling on someone's head and killing them. We haven't seen that, thankfully, like I said, but I think that that's, when you talk about severity, it's either that or the more destructive from a property perspective, you know, someone's flying a gas pipeline to do inspections and they crashed into it and managed to cause what is obviously highly flammable stuff to ignite. So I think from a macro perspective, that's sort of what people think about when they think about drone risk on our end.
The thing that I've read the most about are the close calls with jetliners. I know that, you know, there's been hundreds of close calls with drones almost getting sucked into the engines. And the closest one I read, I don't know how recent that was at Heathrow. A plane had just taken off. And obviously you can't fly the drone into the airspace of the airport. But once the flight takes off and it's still low enough where a drone could intercept it, it came within, you know, tens of feet of being sucked into this and making the whole thing go down. So that's a concern, I think, worldwide.
Yeah, the Heathrow one's interesting because one of our carrier partners is actually based out of London, and there's a fair amount of nefarious conduct with that one because there are, like, you can call them envelopes or barriers, or there's space around an airport, for example, that is supposed to prevent people from flying within drones within that airspace. So that exact area where you talked about where a plane is taking off or landing and enters that sort of, you know, sub 300, sub 400 feet airspace, the drones aren't supposed to be anywhere near it. So, but what they were doing was it was literally a protest. They were halting air traffic deliberately at Heathrow by purposefully flying drones where they shouldn't have been flying them.
I didn't know that.
To interfere with to planes and jetliners. So they're, you know, at least in countries like the UK and in the US, there's part of that airspace management is designed to prevent exactly that, which is also part of the reason why sort of these delivery options get complicated, because those airspace restrictions are real and they're present in a lot of different places. Having some sort of UTM that manages drone traffic at this level, plane traffic that is integrated with one another, like that isn't sort of a series of air towers and everything else, is kind of crucial for that to be avoided as that sort of industry starts to develop.
And Joe, what, you know, as a drone operator, what are some things, I mean, when I first learned how to drive, I went over some curbs and, you know, you just learn that way. So what are some things, some pitfalls that you may have experienced, hopefully minorly, that you would then be able to pass on some advice to folks?
Yeah, exactly. Luckily, I don't have any, you know, crazy stories to tell about a drone going down on an inspection. But really, beyond the standard answer of yes, we follow all the regulations and safe practices, the main thing that we consider as accident reconstruction is hey, we're at a scene here where an accident occurred between two vehicles. We're on a roadway where there's moving traffic. And so the number one rule that we're following is we are not flying that drone over the lanes of travel, because God forbid it goes down. You know, we want it to land in some trees and we'll deal with the damage to our drone, you know, and that would be the end of the story. But we're very, very aware of, you know, the danger that it could cause. God forbid it ended up on the roadway or anywhere near the roadway, frankly. And so when I'm training a colleague of mine who just got their license and we're talking about going out to do an inspection and, you know, where to fly and where not to fly, picture a big highway, you know, we're either flying over top of a nice wide grass median or flying over top of that wide shoulder or tree lining or anything like that. And for us to be able to avoid completely flying over the travel lanes, I think limits the kind of issues of liability or potential risk greatly in a roadway scenario. So
do you have a lot of pushback sometimes from either government agencies or even opposing counsel? I mean, I'm assuming you're retained by one side or the other. Have you ever had someone say, well, we're going to fight this out via motion practice to not let you reconstruct this accident? Or have you, as government agencies said, not over this area, sorry, it's restricted?
Well, so we'll only fly, you know, in a legal airspace. So yes, a lot of times, especially in urban areas, like Travis was indicating, you know, you're so close to an airport, you might be, you know, thousands and thousands of feet away, but you're close enough that you're not able to fly there. And we simply will have to document the scene another way. The only pushback I've ever had, you know, flying on basically public property, you know, over the side of a road is oftentimes still, as this is new technology, law enforcement is not completely aware of the rules and regulations. So I have been in several states pulled over, I'll say, where, you know, a police officer will drive up, I'll safely land the drone, we'll talk for a little bit, I'll exchange some information, registration of the drone, my license, I'll discuss, you know, some of the pre-flight checklist that I go through in terms of understanding, yes, we're in an airspace that is totally legal to fly. You know, the weather is appropriate for this type of flight. This is why I'm here. You know, this is kind of my plan. I'm flying below the legal 400 feet. I'm flying over, you know, like I said, whether it be a median or a shoulder, not over the lanes of travel or any people. And after a brief discussion, I'm always back up in the air and you know, a little bit of education to law enforcement doesn't hurt anybody either. But besides that, I really personally, and neither have my colleagues, seen any pushback in terms of droning an accident.
Do you have to produce an insurance card when you get pulled over?
No, not for flying the drone. It's just
you got to get on this. That's a market for you.
Technically, I guess I don't necessarily have to produce my pilot's license because really the only person who I think would know to ask for that would be like an FAA inspector, which I suppose they're out there driving around. But, you know, I just come prepared, you know, if in fact I do have to speak with a police officer to let them know why I'm there and why I'm allowed to fly.
I think it'd be cooler if a police drone pulled over your drone and you let him on a wild drone chase, you know. It'd be tough because you can't go out of sight. That would be a little bit tough. But
it's funny you mentioned that, Nate, because their drone racing is very much a real thing.
I know,
and getting bigger and bigger.
I'm nerdy enough that I've watched the drone racing league. I have. Yep. Oh yeah.
He doesn't sleep at night.
That's right. Yep. Yep.
Well, to wrap this up. Question to each of you guys, what is I know we've talked about a lot of different uses, coverage, but just something fun, like what to you has been the coolest thing about drone technology that has come out?
I can lead this one off. That's right, Travis. I think because drones are such a unique tool, I think where they will shine is in unique situations. And one of the things that I've seen throughout the news is how drones are being used in disaster relief. And there's a couple really obvious uses in disaster relief situations, whether it be looking for people trapped, you know, underneath an earthquake collapse or something like that, or trapped inside their home in a flood situation, or something simple like helping people navigate, emergency responders navigate an area which has been compromised. But really what has been recently coming out, and this is in Puerto Rico, I think AT&T is the one who set this up, but when a disaster strikes, hurricane, whatever it might be, and cell phone signal is lost, Wi-Fi is lost, and there's really no way for people to communicate, for people to reach out and say, hey, I need help. There have actually been drones which go and temporarily provide cell phone data and Wi-Fi to areas to allow for people to, hey, let their family know that they're safe, reach out and ask for help. And I just think it's a really unique thing to understand that all of these things that we're considering, airspace restrictions, different things like that, federal regulations, they can go out the window in a situation where it's an emergency response. And we can really use technology like this to its fullest potential to help people and you know, be able to do things efficiently in a way that we never could before.
Awesome answer. How about you, Travis?
Hey, Travis, try to follow that up.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think he's right, though. I mean, I think that the key linchpin is where you can sort of leverage drones to truly help people. So one of the things that Joe mentioned earlier, actually, was, you know, the delivery of these medical supplies. And, you know, in a country like, you know, the United States, we have other alternatives, like he was mentioning. I mean, you can drive these things from one hospital building to the next. You can even drive, you know, transplant organs as you need to, or fly them even. But in a lot of countries, they don't have the infrastructure for that. They don't have the time for that. So the delivery of these, you know, these really life-saving, whether it's medications or other services of medical nature, are pretty intense. And then there's the lot less, important from a human perspective in terms of helping people or saving people, but there's still really interesting stuff that's sort of combining emerging technologies, 3D printing drones, for example, in the construction field. Like, they're working to have drones, they have 3D printers on them that can deliver 3D printed goods, like, to the high parts of your skyscrapers where they're needed for installation, things like that. And similarly, sort of delivering, I think New Zealand is trialing some sort of, like, they call it like a lifeguard drone, but basically it can go to surfers that are out in the surf and need help and deliver sort of life preservers, that kind of thing. So, you know, they're just increasing in their applications, particularly as the technology gets better and better. So it's really fascinating to see where they might go.
And invest in drones. I'm telling you, I saw that this morning, getting ready.
Yep. Wendy and I are going to start our own fund. So if you guys want to join it, it's a very limited hedge fund. It's only, it's like probably $50 a person. So, you know, get in now.
I was just going to say, I think only other thing I'd add there that is kind of cool is I think they actually are either actively or will soon be doing some actual drone taxis in Dubai.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That's the coolest thing, I think. You know, people think of quadcopters as being, like I said, the size of a puppy or something, but they're technically drones, the ones that can, you know, carry six people. And urban air mobility, which I think is what that's called, I mean, like, using, you know, drones to ferry people around cities, I think would eliminate, obviously, the gridlock of traffic. And there's only so many subways you can build, right? There's a limited space there, but there's kind of unlimited space above us. And so I think that's going to be the coolest development in the next 10 years or so.
But. Thank you, everybody. This has actually been a really fun discussion. Again, I know Nate does too. Love talking about drones. Mm-hmm. And thank you guys for sharing today.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having us.